The Faces of Contemporary Islam, Fresh Perspectives on Theory, Practice, and Foreign Policy. A Women's Foreign Policy Group Conference in Washington, D.C., featuring Carnegie Scholars. This November 18, 2008 podcast is a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. John L. Esposito gives the following keynote address, Who Speaks for Islam? Letter to President-elect Obama. Mr. Esposito is a professor and founding director of the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at the Walsh School of Foreign Service, Georgetown University. Gail Lefkowitz-Kitch, the vice chair of the Women's Foreign Policy Group Board, moderates.
I am Gail Kitch. I'm the vice chair of the Women's Foreign Policy Group Board, and it is certainly an honor. It's an honor and a privilege to welcome everyone. A little bit of a cold morning, but thanks for making it over. Wonderful to have you here today for the Women's Foreign Policy Group Islam Conference with Carnegie Scholars. This conference is part of the Carnegie Corporation of New York Islam Initiative to promote better understanding of Islam through the support of the foundation. Through the support of the foundation, sorry about that. The Women's Foreign Policy Group, I didn't necessarily write all these remarks myself. The Women's Foreign Policy Group has been able to hold several programs in Washington and New York, which have highlighted the important and timely work of the Carnegie Scholars, whose work is notably in-depth and nuanced, and which addresses historical, cultural, and political aspects of Islam. The Women's Foreign Policy Group has been very proud of these programs through the years, which have helped enhance the dialogue on these important issues. For this reason, we are very excited about being able to bring a very impressive group of scholars here today. It's really kind of a marvelous conference, for this important exchange and dialogue amongst themselves and with the foreign policy community. We are delighted to have some of our board members with us today, and I think I'll be introducing them a little bit later. They're not here yet. They'll be arriving late. I'm here, so that's, you know. So I'll introduce them when they come. If they come in a little bit later, I will introduce you, because I think it's important to know who some of the leadership of the group is. We have some diplomats and State Department officials will be also joining us a little bit later. We are especially pleased that our colleagues from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, Patricia Rosenfield, director of the Carnegie Scholars Program, who I know I just saw earlier today, is here certainly, just met her this morning, and Hilary Wiesner, is Hilary here? Yes, there you are. I didn't have a chance to meet you. Sorry, Hilary, nice to see you here. Director of the Islam Initiative, and Ambika Kapoor, also here I know, program assistant on the Journalism Initiative, who could join us and have been so helpful in making this initiative such a success. And Bika, did you want to say hi? There she is. Okay. This is really the group that's made this such a success, sitting there with Pat, with the person who really has made it a success. Yes. It's a really very special program. And now, it is now my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for the conference, Dr. John Esposito. He's a university professor, professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies, and founding director of the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at the Walsh School of Foreign Service, Georgetown University. He is editor-in-chief of the four-volume, the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Modern Islamic World, the Oxford History of Islam, the Oxford Dictionary of Islam, the Islamic World, Past and Present. The six-volume, Islamic Encyclopedia of the Islamic World and Oxford Islamic Studies Online. His more than 35 books include Who Speaks for Islam, What a Billion Muslims Really Think, Unholy War, Terror in the Name of Islam, The Islamic Threat, Myth or Reality, Islam and Politics, Political Islam, Radicalism, Revolution or Reform, Islam and Democracy with Jay Vole. His writings have been translated into more than 28 languages. A former president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America and the American Council for the Study of Islamic Societies. He's currently an ambassador for the UN Alliance of Civilizations, member of the World Economic Forum's Council of 100 Leaders. Professor Esposito is a recipient of the American Academy of Religion's 2005 Martin E. Marty Award for the Public Understanding of Religion and of Pakistan's Qaid-e-Azim Award for Outstanding Contributions in Islamic Studies. He served as a consultant to the U.S. Department of State and to governments, corporations, universities, and the media. In 2003, he received the School of Foreign Service Georgetown University Award for Outstanding Teaching. Please join me in welcoming Professor Esposito.
Great, thank you. Thank you. Neither the qualities that got me the award nor some of the other awards will be evident this morning, but I'm extraordinarily conflicted today, because I was saying to somebody that I had sort of prepared my comments on one of my innumerable plane rides, and so felt very secure about it. So I got up about 4:30 this morning and thought, well, I'll just take a little look at this and cut it back. Well, the net result from 4:30 to 7 is that it seemed to get longer rather than shorter. But fortunately, the way I look at it is that I made the print larger, so hopefully I can do this in a reasonable amount of time. One of the depressing things, and I feel I should say this because it will show another conflict, which is that I'm suddenly aware of the fact that I think I'm getting older, is that one of your participants, and I won't name her, I remember when I first got into the field in the early 70s, my wife and I were buying carpets in Damascus. And there was a couple with their cute little kids. And when they left, I went and I looked at the sign-in, and the sign-in had the name Ibrahim Abu Lugud and his wife Janet, and they were like heroes to me. And I thought, geez, I should have met them. And their little kids grew up. So it's kind of depressing. I mean, I think it's great that some people grow up, but the idea that I sort of have to deal with that, you know, is as bad as this young co-ed who came in the other day and said, my mother said I should come in to see you. She studied with you 40 years ago. And I snapped at her and said, don't you ever say that to me again, nor say it in front of other people. But in any case, here we are today. What I want to lay out for you is, let me preface it by saying that, you know, from my point of view, I was a very strong, and I'm a very strong supporter of President-elect Obama. However, whatever the disasters of the Bush administration, and they are legion, it doesn't mean that we're out of the woods. And I have I'm positive, but I have some serious concerns about how things will play out in terms of the Muslim world in general, and particularly with regard to the Middle East. And we can get to that at some point. But I want to give you a sense of how I see the context post 9/11, and what I would be saying to the president-elect with regard to how we should be looking at the Muslim world and dealing with the Muslim world. Post 9/11 and the aftermath dramatically underscored for some the sense of a conflict between the United States and the Muslim world. Well, more than a conflict, a sense of a conflict. And some described it also, and do describe it, as a conflict between Christianity and Islam. Now, many of us will say that's beside the point, but the point is there are people out there that say that. We have militant evangelicals, we have militant Muslim preachers, who will play up not just the Muslim world and West dimension, but that it has to do with Islam and Christianity. And two contending, and I believe distorted, positions then emerge. One is an American perception of a war on global terrorism, constituting this as a kind of global war. And on the other hand, a perception in many parts of the Muslim world of a war against Islam in the Muslim world. A key challenge and a question for the new administration in crafting its foreign policy in order to have one that's more effective and will restore America's moral stature. I prefer stature. I always used to say moral authority, but the problem with that is you can just work that through. Part of the problem is that we think we have all this authority, let alone moral authority. But America's moral stature is an awareness of what went wrong. Well, in addition to Bernard Lewis going wrong in terms of a lot of the advice that he gave to the administration, and to show you I'm open-minded, my seminar on Islam and global terrorism is reading Bernard's book today, What Went Wrong. But the real question is, what really went wrong? And I think part of what really went wrong is that the dominant voices and influences have in fact been neocons, militant Christian right, the terrorists themselves, authoritarian Muslim regimes, lobbies, etc., etc. We have even, I think, more critically in this post 9/11 world, and I see this hopefully as disappearing with the new administration, a McCarthyite context in which to dissent is to be unpatriotic. And the pressures that go with that, both in terms of the academy, in terms of government, and certainly also in terms of media and the kind of media coverage. But even more significant is what I call the battle of the experts. Okay, and this puts your average policymaker, your average citizen, in a very tight spot. What do you do when you have people with stellar credentials taking diametrically opposed positions? You know, that's an issue. And clearly it's an issue when you have a president who's not informed to begin with or interested in international policy. How does he then decide when Powell and Rumsfeld disagree, let alone when Bernard Lewis and others, you know, disagree, etc.? Well, part of the problem is there was no really looking at the other side often for the administration. Also, it's the voices and the messages of the religious extremists and the terrorists that capture the headlines, capture attention, and often come to represent who Muslims are and what they want. You know? And so when we often say, you know, why do they hate us, or why the anti-Americanism, it's often geared to, well, we know what the answer is. They hate everything we stand for, and how do we know that? And so we key selectively to what some extremists said. I mean, it's as much as keying to Reverend Parsley and John Hagee in terms of taking a certain kind of position on, you know, where do Christians sort of stand. Who's missing and who has been missing? And who must not be missing if we're going to formulate a foreign policy that can be sensitive to the realities in the Muslim world? The vital missing piece is indeed the majority of Muslim. What do majorities of Muslim think? Say, we consistently have people talking about them rather than going directly to them. Okay? A. B, we make the same problem when we deal with Islamic movements. You see. We don't talk to Islamic movements. If we have conferences, half the time we can't invite them, or we don't think we should. Better to have people talk about them and never have them at the table, and in fact, even have people talk about them who've never met them. There is a somewhat prominent person who's written a book on Hamas and who's an expert in Washington, with a major think tank, and has interviewed two Hamas people. Both of them were in Israeli prisons. So you write an expert book on Hamas, okay, and is invited to testify in a trial about zakat committees, and acknowledges that having been in the West Bank and Gaza, never bothered to go visit or interview anybody on a zakat committee. This battle of the experts, I think, is really important. And on the other hand, the not knowing what majorities of Muslims think. Well, our polling data from a variety of groups, Pew, Zogby, and I would argue especially the Gallup organization, provide us with a far more comprehensive view. Gallup has the most comprehensive, systematic study of Muslim opinion across the world. It embraces more than 35 countries, includes more than 50,000 one-on-one interviews. And it's face-to-face interviews done in local languages and embraces young and old, educated and illiterate, female and male, urban, village, and rural. The random sampling represents the voices of 90% of the world's Muslims, or roughly a billion Muslims. And much of that data is looked at and analyzed in a book that Dalia Mugahid and I did called Who Speaks for Islam. But let's take a closer look at the policy issue, what the data tells us and what the implications are. First of all, it counters a good deal of the conventional wisdom. When people, for example, again, experts say, well, how do Muslims feel about democracy? And then they answer it right away. You remember when we said, why do they hate us? They hate our democracy, our human rights, our gender equality, etc. We always like to assert, we lead, with all of our ideals, sometimes not what our realities and practices are. So, who are the extremists? Do Muslims desire democracy? What about women's rights? What do women really want? Well, we really don't need to talk a lot to women to know that. Again, we ask experts, and then we interview westernized elite women within a society like Iraq, because they can speak in front of the camera, they speak English, and they tell you how women feel some reform is going to be disastrous. Nobody bothers to say how representative are they. Because obviously, if they dress like us, they look like us, and they talk like us, they must be enlightened. It's a slight exaggeration, but leave it to Mediterranean hyperbole, but not that much. Now we have statistical evidence. The voices of a billion Muslims, not individual experts or extremists, to look at the actual scene. What's the most important insight? The most important insight is an obvious one, but still one that a lot of people try not to acknowledge. That the primary issue, the primary clash, is not about religion and culture, it's about policy. And here I think that the report that was put out about a month ago, that was put together by a variety of organizations, including the Saban Center and the and others, and it was a bipartisan committee, was right on the mark in talking about the fact that it's foreign policy, it's not religion and culture. It's not that religion and culture don't play a role. We all frame, if we're religious people, what we do and legitimate it in the name of religion. And if we're not, we do it in the name of some other ideology. But the reality of it is, if you look at, Osama bin Laden's statements and others, they talk about political and economic grievances, and then they legitimate and mobilize by appealing to religion. But we have to look at what are the grievances. Let's look at the question of why do they hate us. The first thing to realize is that we conflate hatred for America with anti-Americanism, and that becomes a problem. Terrorists hate us. Terrorists want to kill us, or want to kill you, not me, obviously. But, you know, I was in a... My only gang war was in Brooklyn was when I finally decided to try one, and all I remember is some guy on top of me pounding my head into the cement. So ever since then, I'm everybody's good guy and a pacifist on occasion. But in any case, we conflate why do they hate us with anti-Americanism. The majority of people who are anti-American, not only in the Muslim world, but in Europe and the rest of the world, don't hate us. They often admire us, sometimes envy us, but see us often as not living up to our principles and values, or fear our notion of a new global order, or what looks to them like neocolonialism. We can condemn the French notion of the mission to civilize and the white man's burden of the British, but somehow it's okay, as Max Boot and others tell us, and Bernard Lewis, for us to feel that we have this God-ordained mission to promote democracy. And so if you look at New York Times, when Condoleezza Rice was interviewed, it was astonishing. You have a president who has, a 20% rating. We have a country that's in incredible debt, that's mired down in wars, and we're reassured that a major contribution of the administration is promoting democracy, and there's even a link and a happiness that it's our promotion of democracy that brought Kuwaiti women their right to vote. Absolutely fascinating. Read of history. Okay, that's part of our problem in terms of not being able to distinguish between the anti-Americanism and the hatred, because if we make that distinction, then we can ask more correctly and more constructively why the anti-Americanism. Because at the end of the day, when you say why do they hate us, people who hate us are, as far as I'm concerned, most of them beyond the pale. Okay, but the anti-Americanism, which is broad-based and goes outside the Muslim world, begins to tell us as Americans that it's not simply something that is culture-specific or religion-specific, and that there are deeper reasons. What we see is, first of all, that despite anti-Americanism and anti-British sentiment, Muslims do admire a good deal of what we stand for. In contrast to 57% of Americans who asked what they admire about Muslims and Islam said, nothing, or I don't know. Muslims who have their resentments globally also, on the other hand, talk about admiring our technology, our expertise, our knowledge, and the second most frequent, our freedoms and our democracy, our rule of law, our transparency, our notion of social justice. Now, what are Muslim attitudes towards freedoms? Majorities greater than 90% in Egypt, Indonesia, and Iran said they would include free speech. And indeed, significant numbers added freedom of assembly and religion as a fundamental guarantee if they were to draft a new constitution. Asked to describe their dreams, it wasn't about fighting jihad in the sense of some sort of aggressive holy war. It was about better jobs, economic well-being, prosperity, and a better future for their children. I mean, not exactly a stunning sort of conclusion. This response ranged from a high of 70% for Indonesians to 54% for Iranians. But while admiring much of the West, in terms of achieving progress, majorities of Muslims see their religion and culture as very important. Okay. They're not closed to the West, but they don't see themselves as simply following a Western paradigm. And this is very important. So, for example, they want democracy, but not democracy with secularism. They want democracy with religious values, which will often be expressed as they want Sharia to play a to be a source of law. But what they mean by Sharia is very broad. It can mean many different things. But they do not want Sharia as the source of law, nor do they want a theocracy. Contrast that with more than 50% of Americans, close to like 54% of American Christians, who believe that our legislation should be based on the Bible. And the high 40 percentile of those same Christians believe that their religious leaders should be involved in drafting those laws. Okay. So the issue, the other thing is that at the same time, they're eager to have better relations with the West. And this is not only, I'll come back to it later, on the part of moderate, but also people who we call politically radicalized. The irony is that the politically radicalized in our survey, 7%, 91 million Muslims who are politically radicalized when it comes to the U.S., i.e. they believe 9/11 was justified, for example. They are not violent, but their attitudes make them sympathetic, okay? When you actually take a look, they more than the mainstream believe that democracy is the way forward and that relations with the West are important, but they far more than the mainstream believe that will never happen, that the United States is not interested, and some other European countries are not interested in really promoting democracy as self-determination, but rather democracy as whatever the Western brand of, desired brand of democracy is. And unless we approve of the outcome of an election, we're not about to accept it. And we have some examples of that already. To get a sense of the idea that it's not a blind anti-Americanism, Muslims globally distinguish very carefully between the U.S. and the U.K., Bush and Blair on the one hand, and France and Germany on the other. Okay, very, very clearly. And remain also critical of other Muslim countries as well, such as Pakistan. 30% of Muslims globally, you know, are negative when it comes to Pakistan. So it's, but the point here with regard to the West is that it's not a blind hatred of the West. And it's not a civilizational hatred. It's a policy. And where you see the policy is the distinguishing between Bush and Blair. So it's not even the U.S. and Britain in some ways, but, you know, Bush and Blair, the leadership, and the leadership in France and Germany and the kinds of policies that are pursued. While 74% of Egyptians have unfavorable views of the U.S. and 69% say the same about Britain, only 21% had unfavorable views of France. It's very interesting that, for example, when you look and talk about Canada, which we describe as the U.S. without its foreign policy, 67% of Kuwaitis have unfavorable views of the U.S. and only 3% of Canada. So you see that, you know, 64% of Malaysians say the U.S. is aggressive. Only 1 in 10 associates that quality with France and Germany. The aggressive label is very much there also when it comes to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Vast majorities say it did more harm than good, including 90% of Egyptians, 87% of Senegalese, and 57% of Iranians. What's the main concern here when it comes to democracy in the future and policy? It's what's regarded as America's double standard, or America and Britain's. Hypocrisy when it comes to the promotion of democracy and human rights, i.e., you promote them in one part of the world but not the other. Ambassador Haas, when he was in the State Department during the Bush administration, acknowledged that. He called it democratic exceptionalism, that it existed with every president. And it's true, whether Democrat or Republican, a democratic exceptionalism when it came to the promotion in the Middle East. A, we didn't promote it, and B, what do we do, and what do we continue to do? We support authoritarian regimes. These are all seen as, therefore, hypocritical, okay, and as a double standard, and undermine our moral stature and our believability in the region, and raise profound questions about them. Why is this the case? And what you see many Muslims concluding is that it must be something about our religion and our culture and who we are. And so a major complaint is, stop denigrating Islam and considering Muslims as less equal and Muslim lives as less important, less valuable. And here, both the example of Iraq and very much the example of the American position during the Israeli-Hezbollah war and the way in which we sat on our hands at that time. And indeed, we not only sat on our hands, but at the same time, the Secretary of State was going to the Middle East to talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict, you know. And it's not just Arabs who felt this way. Gideon Levy, who writes in Haaretz, at one point said, please don't come, in one of his editorials. He said, because if you come, you're raising expectations, and we know ahead of time you're not going to be prepared to really do anything on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And more importantly, you're not doing anything on Lebanon right now. It undermines the credibility. what can the West do to improve its relations? What do Muslims wind up telling us? And then I'll get to more specific policy recommendations. The most frequent responses were that the West needs to demonstrate more respect for Islam, regard for Muslims as equal, not treat them as inferior. It's reflected in Lebanese respondents' statements only days after the end of the war with Israel, in which respondents blamed America almost as much as they blamed Israel. They, the West, quote, should consider us humans and should end war and be at peace with the Muslim world. The West should treat Muslims equally to improve their relations because they look down upon us. One of my colleagues took a picture in a destroyed area in Lebanon, and the sign said, "Thank you, America, for promoting democracy," you know, in our region. I mean, it was coming. How accurate, how much more time do I have, roughly?
5 minutes.
Okay. How accurate is this assessment? I'm only going to give you two statistics on this. The attitude about how Americans feel about Muslims. Anti-Muslim sentiment is widespread in the West, okay? Asked how much prejudice they had, 72% of Americans said they had no prejudice towards Jews. Only 34% would say that with regard to Muslims. Significant percentages said that they believe that the religion of Islam was a problem. The good news is they believe Muslims are religious. The bad news is Islam is an extremist religion. So much so that 49% of Americans believe U.S. Muslims, don't believe that U.S. Muslims can be loyal citizens. Okay. Americans' view of Islam is even worse. 59% of Americans say they have unfavorable views of the faith. Okay. Now, let me briefly just refer to the fact that when it comes to women and women's rights, that majorities of Muslims, even in countries like Saudi Arabia, of men and women, believe that women should have equal rights. Equal rights, citizenship, education, employment, senior levels of employment, and to vote without any interference. Okay, but what can we say about where we need to go from here and scenarios? It seems to me that there are two broad scenarios. And here I would refer you to World Policy Journal. Dahlia and I did an article there, and we lay out the scenarios. And I don't have time to get into them, but one of the scenarios is that we continue with the business as usual, that we define our interest and our security by supporting authoritarian regimes, that we see the differences simply cultural, or if you will, simply, quote, a war of ideas, and therefore what we attempt to do is simply emphasize public affairs, or PR, rather than policy issues. And that's a major difference. When you ask Americans and people in the Muslim world what should be done, they both agree on promoting better understanding, education, exchange. But Americans stop there. Foreign policy is not on their window. The same thing occurred during the Bush administration. Secretary Powell saw public diplomacy as public relations and policy. The reason why we failed, among others, in our public diplomacy is we consistently never addressed the policy. I was asked with five other people to review all of our government agencies' public diplomacy programs a number of years ago, and we were told when we were invited and when we first sat down, although we were not held to it at the end of the day because five out of six of us refused to hold to it, but basically we were told ahead of time that we should evaluate the public diplomacy programs, but we were not to discuss foreign policy, that the Bush administration did not want us to discuss American foreign policy, but we should evaluate public diplomacy and make recommendations. All right. Okay, let's move beyond the future scenarios and let's talk about a new direction. A new direction has to emphasize a different approach. On the one hand, we have to go with where President Bush was correct. It's one of those few times that I can say I fully support the soon-to-be former president. And that is, he said, we have to have a three-pronged approach, as you'll remember, military, economic, and public diplomacy. But what we have to realize is military fights terrorism. It doesn't fight effectively a war against global terrorism, or it doesn't fight global terrorism, because global terrorism goes beyond killing, capturing, or containing. Okay, that's where our diplomacy comes into play. Okay, so you know, part of it is that you can do the military and economic, but it's really the public diplomacy. The target for us, and what our data shows is not the vast majority of Muslims. 93% of Muslims don't believe 9/11 was justified, admire the West but are critical of it, may have problems with our foreign policy, But they're not potential radicals. Our target should be the 7%, the potential radicals. They are not violent. They're no more religious than others. They're better educated, more internationally minded, do better economically, believe in democracy and relations with the West, as I said earlier, even more than the mainstream do. But they're far more cynical. What do they fear? They fear Western intervention, invasion, dominance, political, military, and cultural. That's our target audience for public diplomacy. But we can't address the public diplomacy unless we do more than the PR. We can't just do videos, you know, telling people you just don't understand this, as it were. Because the problem is an awful lot of these people, if you listen to the profile I just gave you, they're also more internationally aware, these potential radicals. Many of them know us. They not only know us through the media, they visit here, etc. You know, and so they should be the focus for what we do. Because in this war, which, I mean, global terrorism is going to be with us, but the real question is, do you limit the reasons, do you limit the credibility of extremists and terrorists who attempt to recruit, and in recruiting, are not recruiting by simply saying, we have to kill the kuffar. The emphasis is going to be in terms of political and economic grievances. The West is a threat to us in a variety of ways. So we need to be aware of those issues, and President-elect Obama has to be willing to address those issues. This means a significant shift, not only in public diplomacy, but also in policy. We need to be emphasizing diplomacy over military response. Military you use selectively, but it's diplomacy. We need to, as a result of diplomacy, we should be open to talking to people who disagree with us. Don't we do that all the time? We did it with North Korea. But when it came to Iran and Syria, we were always threatening militarily. We need to emphasize economic development, educational development, technological development. Majorities of Muslims say that that's what they're looking for. They welcome that kind of, if this word is understood, intervention as assistance. Intervention as assistance. We need to use our leverage, our political leverage, our military leverage, our economic leverage, with Arab and Muslim regimes to get them to open up and develop stronger civil societies rather than to fall silent as we did in the last Egyptian elections. Rather than, after the elections of Hamas, however much many may deplore Hamas, they were elected in full and fair democratic elections. That's not the case for Ben Ali in Tunisia. It's not the case for Mr. Mubarak. It's not the case for a whole slew of other people who we live with, who we get along with. It's not the case for countries like Saudi Arabia that doesn't even have, you know, this kind of system. I think that really becomes a major challenge. And I think the final thing is that what we need to realize is, and this is going to be, I think, the nut breaker, and so I'll just put it right out for you. I think Obama is an internationalist president. I did a piece that was just in the Gulf News the other day and is on our blog site on that issue. But one of the points I make in that piece is that what we're faced with is how internationalist will he be in the Arab and Muslim world? We can argue for the fact that he was noticeably silent on that issue and avoided any kind of association with Arabs and Muslims, avoided saying what Secretary Powell said, which was, yeah, he's a Christian. You know, he's not a Muslim, but what would be wrong about that? And shouldn't a seven-year-old Muslim be able to dream about growing up to be president? He avoided that, just as he avoided really talking about helping the poor. And at the end of the day, except on occasion, it was all about the middle class, on the one hand, helping the middle class, and then, you know, the question of taxing the upper class. But I think the reality of it is, the question now is going to be, how much will this administration be able to move beyond that rather than have some people convince them that they ought to stay where they ought to stay? And so that's why one has to watch very carefully who are the advisors on the Arab world, the Middle East, and the Muslim world. Because if you look at the advisors during the campaign, it's depressing. And indeed, the one or two people who were really good had to quietly resign. So the question is, what will the appointments look like? And the more bottom line is to be a realist. The realist is, this is a president who will be embraced by the Muslim world at one level, depending on how things play out. But the problem is, and this is a problem that every administration has had, whether Democrat or Republican, is what's going to happen with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And on that one, unless something remarkable happens, it's not at all clear to me that an Obama administration, certainly in its early years, will really take on that issue in the way that it would have to take it on. Thank you.
This has been a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For more information about this and other Women's Foreign Policy Group events, please visit www.wfpg.org.